The Sumner Redstone Professor of Narrative Studies at Boston University. He covered 9/11 for the Boston Globe, wrote the lead news story on the day of the attacks. He's the author of seven previous works of nonfiction, including the number one New York Times bestseller, 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. He was part of the Boston Globe Spotlight team. A finalist for a Pulitzer Prize, lives outside Boston. Mitchell Zuckoff joins us. Mitchell, good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
And by the way, name of the book is Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. Mitchell, by the way, go Terriers, BU class of 1983 right here.
Oh, so, hey. So. Same year as me, but different school.
Really? So we were at the school at the same time. Very cool.
We were.
Very nice.
Down in Rhode Island.
Yeah. No, I was there in 2 years in Warren Towers and then up in by West Campus, up in Austin there. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The towers are still just as lovely as you remember.
Look, there's a certain ambiance about Warren Towers. I tell people, you either get it or you don't, right?
Yeah, the cinder block really goes a long way.
Listen, Paul, you know, Mitchell, it's easy to clean. The tea is right outside, right? Listen, this is... This book, boy, I tell you what I've been able to read of it, an exhaustive book, The Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11. There have been so many books, movies, television specials, tell-alls, supposedly, about 9/11. What made you do this? And it is exhaustive. It's hundreds of pages. But what made you say, I need to do a book on this?
You know, for all of those books, for all those stories, it was shocking to me. There wasn't one comprehensive narrative of the full day, of the full scope of events.
What happened from the minute on? Yeah, what happened? You're right, yeah.
And so, once I realized there was that gap, and I realized that the students I was teaching, the folks I'm around every day, had no independent memory of it, and guys like us, memories start to fade. This felt like something I had to solve. It was like, you know, almost like a puzzle. How do I make sure I can share this with the next generation, but also refresh the memories that were so vivid for us who lived through it?
Yeah, and you know, the generation that I work with, the generation that you teach now at BU, Mitchell, for our generation, that moment was kind of our Pearl Harbor or our JFK assassination, where we remember where we were. I remember I was working at a different radio station. I remember the last thing my co-host said before my producer pointed up at the monitor in the studio and said, "What the heck?" And I originally thought, okay, maybe a plane crash. When I saw the second one, I said, that's a terrorist attack. So I applaud you for doing this to fill in the gap for the guys and gals you teach now to tell them that this was our JFK or Pearl Harbor moment.
Exactly. And for many of the people I talked to for this story, for this book, these people weren't ready in the first years. Some of them have had really hard days and really difficult days afterward. Mm-hmm. And so, in a way, the passage of time became an ally, not an eraser. So, in a way, this was the book that had to be written right now. It couldn't have been written 5 years after or even 10 years after. And so, trying to fill that gap and make sure that people understand exactly what you're talking about, that feeling, that shock. We weren't... Now, if a plane hits something, our first thought is it terrorism? Mm. But you're right. You know, back then, we were thinking, oh, how could on such a clear blue sky day a pilot be... You know, we thought it was a small plane. How could a pilot be that incompetent?
Yeah.
But then, obviously, when the second plane goes in, we realize the world has changed.
And what it hit that day, the World Trade Center, and what terrorists understand, Mitchell, is that they understand the symbolism in American life and American culture, not only here, but, you know, places like the Eiffel Tower and the Vatican and the Parthenon, and they understand to hit the stuff that, okay, can be cleaned up, for lack of a better term, and I don't mean to be callous here, mm-hmm. but all that stuff to be cleaned up, but they know what to hit that will leave a mark on the psyche. When you saw the World Trade Center towers collapse eventually, as they did in the most important city on the planet, maybe in the universe, man, that was tough to see.
Yeah, it's such a great point, because the nature of terrorism is exactly that. They're not going to take our military on head on. So they're going to try and undermine the confidence to destroy the strength by, you know, symbolically destroying some symbol of strength, mm-hmm. whether it's the Pentagon or certainly the towers. And so that becomes, you know, the nature of terrorism. And, you know, for a very small amount of money and a tremendously evil mindset, you can accomplish, if you will, it's the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah,
you can
yeah.
accomplish something like that.
This to a lot of people, Mitchell, and it did not come as a surprise.
Mm.
You and I both remember Ramzi Youssef, the first, and people
yeah.
are surprised that young people that I work with at other operations, news operations, say, well, you know, there was a first attack on the World Trade Center. And they're like, really? I said, yeah, truck bomb.
Yeah.
You know, they tried to take it out from the bottom. And Ramzi Youssef, I think, had always said, Mitchell, we will do this eventually. We're going to get you. I failed this time, but we're going to get you.
When he was being, you know, taken in, he was actually flown past the Twin Towers. And the story is that he was unblindfolded, and the agent who was overseeing him showed him that they're still standing. And, you know, he then, at that point, said exactly that. They wouldn't be, you know, if we had a little bit more, you know. He made it clear that he was not finished.
Yeah, you know, Mitchell, the one thing that has always, and I've learned to stop arguing with, like, people who have the IQ of paint sometimes, but I'm sure in your research for this book, and I'm sure how many interviews you conducted, I can only imagine, I'm sure you encountered people just in general conversation. Well, you know, that was set up.
Yep.
The government
sure.
did that. And it's just, it's mind-boggling how many people, Mitchell, for whatever reason, fear the inability to believe that something so technologically simple could have done this. The conspiracy theories on this just yep. drive me crazy.
Me too. You know, I open the book, and near the beginning of the book, I say, facts are stubborn and powerful. This is a true story. The problem with the conspiracy theorists is that they start with a conclusion. They've decided something, and then they try to, you know, shape information to backfill and fit that conclusion. And this is the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
We start with a question. What happened? To whom it happened? Did it happen? Who did this? And why? And how? And then we build on that. And any time a fact doesn't fit, we re-examine and try to figure out, okay, why is that? Journalism and the work that I do as a nonfiction author is the exact opposite of conspiracy theories. And the problem with conspiracy theories is once you engage them, it's a game of whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
You knock one down and three more pop up.
Yeah, so, you know, and especially now with the movie, and I'm a big space runt, you know, growing up, you and I are the same age.
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, the Apollo guys were my heroes. I knew everything. And again, now you're seeing that with the moon landing never happened, the radiation.
Right.
And I just want to tell these people, shut up, you have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't mind questions, but the problem is that unfounded conclusion, the idea that you've got it figured out, and then, you know, I could go on for a long time on this.
How long did this take 100. You, and how many interviews did you do?
Hundreds and hundreds of interviews, hundreds of, you know, literally tens and tens of thousands of documents. And this was close to a 5-year project, but, you know, as you mentioned, this really goes back 18 years for me. So this has been, even as I was writing other books, even as I was doing other things, my mind kept going back. I've always been fascinated, just because, you know, just you described it perfectly. When there's a seminal event like this, you know, a marker in our lives where you know where you are, and you can, you know, those of us who are old enough remember what life was like beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different world. We never talked about the homeland. We never had these kinds of thoughts about any time something happens, we're thinking terrorism. You know, I mentioned in the book that on 9/10, terrorism, there happened to be a Gallup poll, and terrorism wasn't on anybody's radar.
No.
It wasn't just not considered an important factor in American
because
life.
We saw terrorism, Mitchell, as a bomb blowing up a cafe in Tel Aviv.
Right, exactly. It was, you know, back early in the day when I was first a young journalist, we actually had a word for that. In shorthand, we would say, oh, man, that's Afghanistan. to mean that so far away, it doesn't have a direct bearing on our readers or our audience. And what an irony that, of course, Afghanistan becomes the locus of this terrorist act.
The thing that just I got from all of this, Mitchell, is that it's amazing now in retrospect, hindsight, 2020 and all that, of how essentially porous our aviation security was before that. The fact that, basically, the cockpit doors did not have a lock. I mean, things that, you know, you and I as casual travelers would have expected. Oh, I could never get into the cockpit. They probably lock it. And no, it look what happened.
You know, if they did have, some did have locks, but they all had one common key.
Yeah.
So if you, I mean, you know, and flight attendants had this key, and a million, you know, thousands of pilots had the same key. So it was essentially like it didn't have a lock. But the number that I always come back to, and you're onto it, to enormously important factor here. The FAA and 9/11 had a no-fly list of exactly 12 names. At the same time, the State Department had a tip-off terrorist list of 60,000 names, including two of the terrorists who flew on 9/11. The head of aviation security for the FAA was unaware that State Department list even existed. They weren't talking. Two essential federal agencies are not talking to each other about a direct threat to American life.
I mean, you would think, Mitchell, and again, the author of the book Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11, Mitchell Zuckoff is joining us, you would think that some president of the United States or some executive staff member would have pulled everybody into the Oval Office at one time or said, listen, this is not a discussion. We merge all these lists. We talk better because something here could happen. But again, of course, it didn't.
Yes, that's exactly right. And you know, the 9/11 Commission, I think, did a really good job of pointing that out, that the warning signs were flashing red.
Mm-hmm.
This was not, you know, even as we were sort of dismissing the idea of a guy, you know, in flowing robes inside a cave, the fact is we were still fighting this last war. You know, we were still planning for Russian bombers flying over to the North Pole and defending against that, when in fact all these signs, whether it was the USS Cole, whether it was, as you mentioned, the 1993 bombing of the Trade Towers, what was happening in, you know, the bombings elsewhere, whether it was Lebanon, whether it was, you know, in Africa, these were drums that were pounding and getting louder and louder, and we just weren't listening.
Mitchell, the aspect of getting people to talk, we have only about a minute before we have to take a break, and then we'll come back and wrap up with you. Getting people to talk, easy, difficult, in between, various?
It certainly varied, but it was easier than I imagined because they decided to trust me, I think, because I had been there at the beginning. I showed them my stories from 9/11, my stories in the immediate aftermath, and I just gave them time because I had as many years as I needed for this. There were people who never talked about this, who it took a year of discussions, literally, back and forth, whether they were ready, and I could be patient, and I'd love to tell you about a couple of them.
Sure.
You know, these are remarkable people.
Yeah, let's do that. We'll take a break. Mitchell, stand by. We're going to put you on hold here. Mitchell Zuckoff is the guest. The name of the book, Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11. And yes, there have been a lot of books written about this, magazine articles, movies, television, mainstream broadcast, HBO. But Mitchell's book is the first book that has a definitive timeline of what happened, where, involving who, and what time. A few minutes left with author Mitchell Zuckoff. The book, Fall and Rise, The Story of 9/11, a timeline of exactly what happened on that fateful day. Mitchell, before the break, you wanted to talk about a couple of occurrences of people who did talk to you.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, you know, it's amazing to me that so many of these stories are just simply not known. I think about a guy named Dave Tarantino, and he was actually at the Pentagon. We sometimes overlook the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Navy doctor. He was far from where the plane hit. And he could have been a hero had he just gone to the courtyard in the center of the Pentagon and triaged patients. But he took the attitude, he's a Navy man, he is a sailor. And so on a ship, every sailor is a firefighter. And so he moved toward the flames, closer and closer, got to the AE drive, which is this sort of pathway in the middle of the Pentagon, and he saw this punch-out hole with smoke pouring out and people coming out from the Navy Command Center. And he goes inside the burning Navy Command Center. He goes deeper and deeper into the smoky flames, and he sees a couple of guys in there, and he goes deeper, and he tries to, he comes upon a guy named Jerry Henson, who's trapped under a desk, his face pinned against a wall with a bookcase on top of it, and they can't get him out. And it clearly, things are going south. Dave Tarantino was a college rower. He gets on his back, he shimmies underneath the desk next to Jerry Henson and leg presses this desk off of Jerry Henson, pulls him across his body, and gets him out as the building is just about ready to collapse.
Wow.
These are remarkable. So I sat with Dave, and I talked with Jerry, and I talked with one after another. I talked about, you know, the guys of Ladder 6, Jay Jonas, the fire captain, who goes up inside the North Tower and realizes when the South Tower drops that they've got to get out of there. But on their way out, they encounter Josephine Harris, who's basically given up. She's exhausted by the walk down the stairs.
Yeah.
She's hurt. And they slow their descent, knowing that every second counts. But they're not going to leave Josephine behind. And they get deeper and deeper, and the building starts to collapse when they're between the fourth and the sixth floor of the B stairwell. And the building literally collapses around them, and they huddle together, they shelter Josephine, and they realize after, had they gone a little faster, had they not stopped to help Josephine Harris, they would have been out on the plaza. They would have been killed.
Sure. Mitchell, in a couple minutes we have left, the one thing that people don't seem to understand, and we talked about the conspiracy theorists, they're never going to be satisfied. But and I've done extensive reading about this. The way the towers were constructed, with that center spine type of construction, the fact that the walls really weren't load-bearing, that is why, simply, people say, well, no, it's a single plane. It could have never taken the towers down. But again, you and I both know from doing the research here, that inevitably was a big problem because of all that hot burning aviation fuel.
That's exactly right. You know, people want to talk about, well, it couldn't have possibly gotten to the point of melting steel. It doesn't need to. The aviation fuel, as it's burning over the course of an hour, or in the second case, longer than that, it was defeating the load-bearing capacity of the steel.
Mm-hmm.
The structural steel doesn't melt, but it does lose its ability. And there were a number of the load-bearing of the pillars that were taken out completely. The combination of sliced through pillars and a defeat of the bearing capacity of the other steel was absolutely enough. When you look closely, when you read the NIST report, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, it's a brilliantly explained discussion of why the towers fell.
The name of the book, folks, go out and get it. It's magnificent. Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. Mitchell, I hope that a television producer, I know there have been numerous series about this, but I hope your story finds its way either onto television or on the big screen. Wonderful accomplishment. Mitchell Zuckoff. Any plans for that, Mitchell?
There are, in fact, Paul.
Excellent.
The Lionsgate 3 Arts has purchased it, and
nice.
There are plans for a television event.
Nice.
To time to the 20th anniversary.
Can you get me an extra role in there? Thanks. Mitchell Zuckoff, BU professor, Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. Mitchell, thank you, and go Terriers.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Well, there you go. It's coming to Lionsgate Film. Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. Outstanding.